I am Arab just like you. I am Muslim. What are you doing? Why are you shooting me? I'm not, what do you want from me? I'm not a soldier. I'm not anything.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am. Here I am.
And here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
And here I am. We shall never die.
The best way to describe my guest today is, I think, an old soul. I had no idea he was only 27. I thought that he's somewhere between 20 and 60 years old. He looks young, but he is extremely wise. And he's here to explain his perspectives on everything that's been going on in Israel. So here I am with Tamer Masoudin.
Hello, Shai. Nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you. It's actually, I have to say, I don't know you. I've seen a lot of your videos, the things you've been doing online. And it's all been in English. And then yesterday I was kind of like looking at some older stuff of yours and I was like, wait, I want to talk Hebrew with this guy. Fortunately, we can't for this episode. But Tamer, you are an MBA Israeli.
MBA Israeli.
Muslim, Bedouin, Arab, Israeli, who's been really leading a fight against anti-Semitism and anti-Israelism for several years now. Before we begin, I want to start with one simple question. Tamer, what are you fighting for?
Ooh, that is a good question.
Thank you. Professors love when you say that.
That is a good question. I don't think anybody asked me this question before. Usually people ask me, why do you do what you do? Or, you know, what kind of things do you receive online? What kind of feedbacks? But I think the most simple answer would be that I really love my country. I feel that right now we're being under attack by foreign countries, by designated terrorist organizations, by other groups who have, you know, has no, I would say, not our best interest in their mind. And when I look online and I open my Facebook or I open my Twitter and I see like the things that are going, I see lies, propaganda, blatant anti-Semitism. I see the protocols of Elders of Zion. I see the blood libels, all the things that makes me my blood boil to an extent that I can't watch this and not do something about it. And also, as I said it before, I love my country. I'm very passionate about it. I am unapologetically a Zionist. I say this always. And for me, it feels like it's a part of a journey.
Tamer, I have to be honest with you. I get it. You get it. Many people, even people that are watching or listening, might not get it. You are, first of all, just by the looks, you are dark-skinned.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. People would say, okay, it doesn't look like the prototypical Israeli Zionist. Uh-huh. But maybe more important, you're Muslim, Bedouin, Arab, Israeli. Zionism is the movement for self-determination of Jewish people in their ancestral homeland.
Exactly.
Where does a Muslim, Bedouin, Arab find himself in that story, in that narrative?
Well, first of all, I would say that none of the things about me, my identity, my ethnic background, my history, none of them contradict each other. For example, I can be an Arab and Israeli. I can be a Muslim and Israeli. I can be a Zionist and not Arab, not Israeli and not Muslim. Maybe, I don't know, an average American or something like that. So for me, I don't feel like any of those, identities contradict each other. In fact, I believe that they complement each other. And for example, if you take my Bedouin heritage, just to decompose, I would say, one of my core identities, me being Bedouin. So I come from a family in which lived in the desert for I don't know how many generations. And my grandfather was one of the first Bedouins to join the Israeli army at the time before it was officially the IDF in 1948 and fight for Israel independence. And he did this from a core belief that Jews deserve to live in their ancestral homeland. And he passed that torch to my father, who passed that torch to me. who I hope I'm going to pass that torch to my son, my daughter in the years to come. But as I said before, none of those identities really contradict each other. You see, when I look at who am I in Israel, I see it as a strength because I can appeal to so many communities, to so many people using myself, my authenticity and who I am, to send some sort of a message. And when it comes to Zionism in Israel, as you said, Zionism is the belief that Jews deserve to live in their ancestral homeland and have self-determination. And for me, knowing history, knowing that the country that I live in have a, let's say the nation of Israel, the people of Israel have a history that goes back maybe, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, which is very lengthy. You know, empires don't last as long. And to be part of that, even if I'm not from the same tribe, let's say I'm not Jewish, I don't have to be Jewish to feel how powerful it is. And I don't have to be, you know, per se Zionist, let's say, to feel it. Because once you step into Israel, you see it by your own eyes, even if you don't think that Israel is a country that deserves the right to exist with its Jews, with its Arabs. So for me, looking at that from the side and seeing that from the side gave me a lot of power because, you know, as you stated, I'm black. This is the first thing that you can see about me. And I grew up and I faced discrimination. I faced racism and I faced racial abuse, which didn't
in
come...
In Israel.
In Israel, yes, in Israel, which didn't come from Israeli Jews. It didn't come from Mizrahi Jews. It didn't come from Ashkenazi Jews. It came from other Arabs like me who saw me differently because I look the way I look, which is ironically the same kind of abuse I get online every time that I post a video, every time that I do something. I usually open up my comment section and it's somebody with a Palestinian flag telling me, Zionist, hate your kind, you're black, you're slave, you're F-word, you N-word that, in the hopes of, you know, trying to convince me that somehow what I'm doing is wrong. But by insulting me, which I don't know how the logic of that is working, but let's keep it at that. So taking all of this, taking what I said about, you know, being part of this nation, being part of this history, seeing all of this gave me a lot of power. And I really do believe that Israel is a just cause.
And I want to deconstruct and get to that. But before that, I think you have an opportunity here for many people who may not know. What is a Bedouin? What is an Israeli Bedouin?
Sure, let's dive into it. Well, Bedouins are indigenous nomadic tribes that used to live in, that we still live in the desert. And we not only come from the Arab Peninsula and what is now known today as Saudi Arabia and southern Yemen, but throughout the 6th century, throughout the Muslim conquest, the Arab conquest of the Middle East and North Africa, Arabs and Bedouins, let's say, colonized part of it, colonized, conquered, migrated across the Middle East. And originally, the Bedouins weren't black. And most of the Bedouins aren't black. Most of the Arabs aren't black. You would say that they are brown. For me, it's I would say white, but not necessarily black. Our black history comes during those Islamic conquests, during these we say it in Arabic futuhat conquests. During that time, in which roughly between 8 to 12 million black Africans were dragged from north and central Africa all across the Middle East to be used as slaves. And when I was young and I asked my grandfather, like, how is it that we are Israeli, not Israeli, sorry, how is it that we are Bedouins, how is it that we are Arabs, when we are not from the region, we are not indigenous to the Levant or to the Middle East? And he used to tell me that, like, you know, this is what happened many, many years ago. My parents were used to call them slaves and things that, you know, are recent because my grandfather passed away a couple of years now. But when he passed away, he was roughly 90. So when he was a kid, let's say maybe 100 and something years ago, and he experienced that, but it didn't pass to me the knowledge that and the things that he saw and the things that he had to experience. Maybe because he wanted to, I don't know, my family, they wanted to shelter us. They want us, you know, not to, to think about it too much, not to create some sort of a conflict between between other Arabs or something, something like that. But for me, I was curious. I wanted to search. I wanted to learn by myself. I wanted to know as much as I can how far really my history goes and how far back I can go. And you are fortunate, you see, because you can trace your roots all the way back to the land of Israel. Mm-hmm. And sadly now I can't trace my roots to see where I come from. Maybe if I did a DNA test, but it continued. And when I tell people that my mother's maiden name in her official idea is Al-Abid, which translates to Arabic, the slaves. And it wasn't a name that was given to her by the Israeli government or by Israeli officials. It was a name, this is how other Arabs at the time referred to her and to my family, to her brothers, to her sisters, to all of them. So they thought that, okay, if this is what people call us, then this is what we are. So when they registered the name, they registered like Al-Abid. And I changed that name when I was old enough to do that, because I said, ain't no way somebody's going to refer to me as a slave, not in English, not in Hebrew, not in Arabic, not in any language. But yeah, that's a story that I carry with me. Yeah, and I can add to that, then maybe there is a connection here, because when you yourself experience some sort of discrimination, abuse, persecution, hate, whatever, and you look at other group that suffers the same, you interconnect, you find the common ground, you look at each other and say, oh, okay, like when I talk about my experience and you talk about your experience, and we don't necessarily have the same experience, but we feel it, we understand each other.
That's the hope. That I would say that's the best of all worlds, where, you know, I have some positive and some negative experiences, you have your own positive and negative experiences, we talk, we connect on the positive and on the negative. Unfortunately, what happens a lot of the time is people feel so protective, angry, fearful, whatever it is about their negative experiences, they're not even able to see the other side suffering and having their own negative experiences. But let's focus on the hope. What is it like growing up Bedouin in Israel?
It was challenging, but it was fun for the most part, because one of my main struggles when I go to a big city is the fact that I can't see the horizon, and you have no idea how much it pisses me off. Like, for example, if I walked across the street and moved to or went to, let's say, go to Manhattan, I see the tall buildings, it drives me crazy. But what I loved about living in the desert when I was a kid is the fact that I could, you know, stand on the top of my house and look far and see, like, what, 3, 4, 5 miles ahead of me, to see, like, everything surrounding me. And when I was a kid, I used to read books a lot. I used to dive into Harry Potter books and, you know, just like a nerd, finishing an entire book series like in a week and, you know, just reading. And we had a small tree that my grandpa planted for me when I was born on the 23rd of March, 1997, which I used to sit underneath and I would just read my books and, you know, maybe sometimes play with my sisters or occasionally go and play football with my cousins, and we sit, we talk. And because we lived, when I was born, we moved to Segev Shalom, which is a Bedouin village with infrastructure that is located roughly 15 minutes away from Be'er Sheva in the south.
Can you explain for a second why you make it clear if it's with infrastructure?
Of course. So within the Bedouin community in Israel, you have 7 Bedouin villages officially recognized by the state of Israel that houses between, depends really, between 5,000 to 40,000, 20,000 people in each one. In the Israeli Negev, there's roughly 350,000, between 350 to 370,000 Bedouins living. And although the vast majority live in those communities, you have many Bedouins who live in unrecognized villages in the south. which were most of them were places in which, because we were nomadic, we used to go from one place to another to search for food, to search for security, to search for water. But since, you know, countries have borders, you can't really hop from Israel to Jordan and cross and find your, I don't know, your to feed your, to find a crop to feed your cattle and come back, and you can't do that anymore. So most of them settled where they recently been, and after 1948. And because the way Bedouins, not only in Israel, we live our life, is that we live our life in a commune, and the commune is the family. So you can have like a family of 300, 400 people all living in the same, let's say, 1 mile radius away from each other. And you have all these small communities in the southern Israel of Bedouins living next to each other. Now, the reason why I made this distinction between infrastructure and not infrastructure is that most of these communities don't have infrastructure like, you know, running electricity like what we have in right now. They do have water, running electricity, let's say no buses. I went to school when I was a kid, and it was a caravan that I studied in. It wasn't really like a big building, flashy building with like lockers and stuff like that, what you see in the American movies. But this is where I used to study. And the reason why there is no infrastructure can be attributed to two. One is because as a country, it's very, very, very difficult to supply those different communities who are located. You can find like one community, and the next community is like, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 kilometers away from that community. It's very difficult to build and give infrastructure for a community that is so dispersed from one another. From one another. That is one end. So there have been attempts by the Israeli government to incentivize Bedouins to move to either one of the 7 Bedouin villages and cities with infrastructure, with school, with public health. Some were at success. For example, my family, we were born in one of those communities, Wadi al-Naam. And my father, when I was 14, 13, he decided that it's time for us to move. Mainly because he looked at me and my siblings and said, well, I'm not going to wait until somebody comes and put like, a bus line in front of my house. I want to move. I want to find a better future for myself, for my kids, which was a smart move. But most of my extended family from my father's side still live in the same community that they used to live in.
Mm-hmm. And you said there's two reasons. One is the communities exactly. are very disparate. What's the second reason?
Well, the second reason is because the majority of us, the Bedouins, don't really want to move. For mostly, it can be something related to the feelings of, well, I lived in this land for a couple of generations. I don't want to move anywhere. And also it's due to our way of life because, as I stated before, we live our life in a community with our family. In each community, you know, it's the same family, maybe extended family members who live, next to each other. And when you move to, let's say, a place like Sekif Shalom with infrastructure, it's very difficult to have the same commune in the same place. Not only that, you don't have the same space that you used to have. You don't have, a cattle that you can raise as much as you wanted, or sheep that you want to raise as much as you wanted before, which is problematic. And also, it can lead to, let's say, conflict between other families. Especially if you live with a whole different family that you don't know in the same building. And I think that was the first experiment that they tried to do Tel Sheva. But it worked because it's still, you know, it's still
around.
It's still around. It's still a community. But there were a lot of internal fights between different families about land disputes, inner family politics and stuff that are related. So I would say it has to do with, you know, maybe regulators and also the community itself, that the majority don't want to move.
So going back to the tree that your grandfather planted March 23rd, 1997. When you were born.
Yep.
Yeah. So he planted the tree?
So yeah, he planted that tree. I was his first grandson, so he wanted to give me like something special and he gave me the name Tamer, which only in recent years I figured out that it's Turkish and not Arabic in origin, which which I figured out by, you know, taking the Lyft or Uber and sitting with drivers, and they tell me, you know that your name is Turkish? I'm like, I didn't know that, but here we are. So yeah, we lived there up until, I think, when I was 14. Then we moved to Segev Shalom due to my father's request and his foresight to seeing that we want a better future for our kids. And when we moved to Segev Shalom, I was very engaged. I used to skip school to go to volunteer. This is what I used to do.
Volunteer with what?
It depends, really. I had always this feeling that I wanted to give back to my community. I wanted to give back to my people. So I wanted to be part of the local youth movement. I wanted to be part of the student council. I wanted to be part of student groups, organized trips and things like that for the youth. I wanted to be part of anything that is related to the group, to any group in my age. And that was a nice experience, because not only did it gave me all the tools to, you know, to grow up and to succeed as a young man, but also gave me a lot of time to be, you know, to be integrated in my own community, to see like, okay, what are the problems that I can, I don't know, maybe in the future, if I want to ever go to the politics, what can I solve? Or what if, let's say, I want to be a businessman and I want to create business opportunities to young people in my area, in my village, how can I do that?
It's so funny. So I grew up just outside of Tel Aviv, which is, I guess, like about an hour and 20 minutes from Segev Shalom. Mm-hmm. I would also skip school a lot, but not to volunteer or think about my my future as a politician or business, but I would just go to Tel Aviv and take the bus to Tel Aviv to buy used CDs and bum cigarettes from people.
Oh my God.
So it's different experience.
Well, you want to hear the funny thing? Well, when we lived, that was before we moved to Segev Shalom. So my school was maybe 2.5 miles away from me. And as I said before, we studied in caravans. And sometimes we didn't have buses to take us from our home to the school. So either my father used to drive us in his pickup truck, or we used to walk to school. So I used to steal his MP3, put a lot of music into it, mostly black music, and just listen to it while I'm like walking in the desert in the middle of nowhere to my school. Oh, so I get the feeling like about that. CDs, yeah.
So, and then when you were 17, you took a trip that many, many Israelis take, but mostly Jewish Israelis. Mm-hmm. To Poland.
Well, that was when I was 19. Yeah.
What was the trip? What was the impact?
Oh my God! Well, that started way before that. That started really when I was 17. The idea of me visiting Poland, because I remember when we were studying a history class in my classroom, and I had a really good history teacher, and we studied about the Holocaust. And he talked about the Holocaust and he gave us, like, you know, he said, this would happen during World War II to 6 million Jews and all the evil mechanism that were built to exterminate a group of people and all these kind of things that were taught and I was taught by him. And he was Arab like me and he was Muslim like me, but he taught it in a way of, I want you guys to know this, because not because we live in a Jewish country, not because of this, but I want you guys to know this. Because it's important to see what a group of people can do to a group of people when they don't like them, or when they don't want them to be around, or when they want to exterminate them. So that stuck into my head. And, you know, I've heard from my friends, my Jewish friends who go to Poland and they come back and they tell their experiences. And I'm like, okay, I want to go there. I want to see for myself. Mm. I want to learn from myself. I don't want anybody to, you know, to tell me what they experienced. I want to experience myself so that I can be, I can know. So when I was 19, I had an opportunity to go to Poland with my youth movement, the Working and Learning Youth. I was
Norovid Valomet.
Norovid Valomet.
Which I told you I was a member of, but not as devoted as you were. Yeah.
So at 19 we went, and that was a mixed group of Arabs and Jews. We were in the delegation together. We've been to the extermination camps, we've been to the museums, we've been to the sites, and we sat down and we talked, and not only with each other, but also with other groups to see how they feel. And I took a small camera with me and took pictures to show my mom, because she didn't know about this, but she didn't know to what extent. And I wrote a journal about it because I wanted other people to learn from my experience, so it can, you know, push the mostly young Arab men and women in Israel to see, mm-hmm. like, what's all of this about. And I remember when I went back home and I sat down with my sisters and my mom, and they asked me, okay, how was it? Like, did you enjoy Poland? Was it fun? Did you do this and this? Like, well, it was fun, but I want to tell you about what I saw. And when I sat with my mom and I tell her, look, here's a pile of shoes that used to belong to real people that the Nazis took, because they burned them then just left their shoes because they wanted to do something else with their shoes. And this is a pile of hair. And when I sat with my mom, I had tears in my eyes and she had tears in her eyes, because we never thought that, you know, a group of people can be this evil to other group of people. And also, it was a good opportunity for me because my counselor at the time, and he sat down with us, he started to talk to us about the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what?
So maybe if you can give like a 2-minute crash course for people that don't know. I mean,
sure,
it's a
sure,
whole
sure.
lot of things about the Grand Mufti.
The Grand Mufti, yeah. So the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Hajj al-Amin al-Husseini, he was a religious figure, religious leader, and a Palestinian leader prior to 1948, who was very, very vocal about his hatred toward Jews. Not Zionism or Zionist, but Jews, and he was very vocal about it. And if I'm not mistaken, maybe in 1945 or 1944, he met with none other than Adolf Hitler, and he used to write to him, and he used to write to him back, and they shared a common goal, hatred toward Jews, both of them. And he met them, and he also had a legion of Muslim soldiers, if I'm not mistaken, in the Nazi regime that used to fight in for the Nazi government and the Nazis themselves. And there's a famous picture that I use every time somebody comes at Twitter and say, you know, Israelis are Nazis, Zionists are Nazis. Or you want to talk about the people who allied with the Nazis when the Nazis were around? Mm-hmm. We can talk about this, but I don't think you want to have this conversation. You're not ready for that. So I remember that our counsel sat with us and talked to us about the Mufti, and I'm like, nah, no way, because it can't be. I can't believe it. So I did the research myself, and I saw the images, and I saw some of the letters that he wrote, and I'm like, wow. And the teacher said, the counselor, said something that stuck with me. He said, we tend to think about ourselves, and he said, we as Arabs, we tend to think of ourselves as being oppressed all the time by empires, by the British, by the Americans, by this, by that, always somebody to blame. But never once we stopped to think about the time in which we were oppressed. We were the oppressors. So how about that? How about we talk about this? How about we discuss this? And it gave me a lot of perspective at the mm-hmm. time.
I assume that there's two different ways to respond to something like that, because it's shocking. You know, if someone tells you, here's a part of your history that you didn't know about. And by the way, there's a lot of negative parts in Jewish Israeli history. There's a lot of negative part in Israeli communal history, just like in any other society. But one reaction is to say, I don't believe this, or hide it, or feel ashamed by it. But the other reaction is to say, okay, this happened. I can't fix the past. I will fix the future. And it seems like you took the second route. Why? It would have been way easier to just say, oh, you know, okay, that was in the past. Who cares? Now it's different.
Well, my mom in my life, she's a very strong character. And she taught us when we were kids that we don't run away from the truth, even when it's not convenient, even if it's something that can be painful for us to accept. And when I got that piece of information about who was the Mufti in his role with the Nazis and all the other things that he was involved in with the Nazi regime at the time, I was shocked, but not because, because of that, a new information all of a sudden came into my possession. I was shocked because, I thought like we Arabs never talked about this. Nobody ever told me about this. Nobody ever told me about that person. Mm-hmm. So it pushed me into the path of, not self-discovery, but, try to educating myself, trying to learn, trying to see the history, trying to read and figure out things by myself. And that takes a lot of courage, because when you don't have, let's say, a strong support by people who love you and support you and tell you like, okay, you can go down that path and you can figure things on your own by yourself. It can be dangerous. You can learn some inconvenient truths about certain things, but you can do that. And I was fortunate enough, and I'm still fortunate enough to have a family that supports me and push me to really discover things.
I love that. So how did you take the discovery and the that education and turn it into action? What did you start by doing?
At the time when I came back, I did 2 years of national service, and both of those years were in my youth movement. And as I said before, I loved it and I liked it. And when I came back from Poland, I said, you know what? I want to make it my mission to continue to work with youth and kids from different backgrounds, either Arabs and Jews all together, Ethiopian, non-Ethiopian, Christian, and all these mixed groups together. So I want to work with them because this is the fabric of the Israeli society. And this is what I did. So I became something that is equivalent to a teacher like you. So I became...
I told you we're going to find out who the real teacher is today.
You see? So I became like, so I was continued to be a counselor, and I was working in Lod in Jerusalem and in Ashkelon and Ramle and all these places. And I got to see really what is the Israeli society at its, at its most beautiful, at its most ugly, at its most complicated, all the things in all different societies. And I did this because not only that I wanted to see and feel and work and be part of the Israeli society, but I also did it as a mission, because I said, well, if he did that with the Nazis, I want to be better than what he did. So I want to work, I want to build, I want to bridge, I want to create rather than destroy. And this is what I did when I was in my early 20s, up until COVID.
And then COVID, you were in university, right?
No. COVID was the moment that, it was God's way of knocking on my door and say, hey, so what's next? What's your next plan?
So what was next?
What was next was going to Eichmann University. Right. I wanted to study diplomacy. I wanted to study governments and politics, because when I was a kid, and I still believe so, is that places of power, places of politics are, those are the places that run the country or the infrastructure. So I wanted to learn how things work behind the scenes. So I went to Eichmann University. At the time, it was IDC Herzliya. And leaving education was a tough decision. It was really a tough decision because I loved it. And I have students who, till this day, I still talk to them, and some of them are right now in reserves or fighting and doing something that is very courageous. But we still talk, and I still miss them. But that was for me like that was a moment that I said, you know what, it's like self development. So let's see what we can do about this. And also because of the Abrahamic Accords, because prior to me going to the university, there were talks about the signing of the peace agreements, the normalization agreements. And I was so stoked. I was so happy about them. I saw them and I was like, this is it. This is going to be like, this is what's going to open the door for the rest of the Middle East. And we're going to see, Saudis coming to Israel and visiting. We're going to see Qataris coming to Israel and visiting. We're going to see, Tunisians come. So I was extremely, extremely stoked about this. And I wanted to be at the best place I can be to learn and to get the tools that will enable me in the, not so distant future from being the person that will open the doors for those people who want to come and visit and talk to them in Arabic and say, welcome to Israel.
Mm. I love that. And then during university, you got involved in an initiative of monitoring anti-Semitic activity online.
Yes, yes. Well,
tell me about that, because I understand it's a big initiative, thousands of people.
It is. You see, I didn't forget about what I saw in Poland when I was 19. Even when I started studying at 23, 22, I didn't forget it. And I wanted to do something that is more, not only just for myself and just studying and working and doing all of that. So I went to this organization that is called Fighting Online Antisemitism. And I had a hunch that they don't have, at the time, that they didn't have any volunteer who can do this kind of work in Arabic. So I reached out to them and I said, hey, I know how to speak Arabic. I know how to read. My English is also near perfect. So I can be the guy that can sit on the laptop and look at anti-Semitic posts in social media and report them, classify them, see what kind of trends online there are, and to determine if they are dangerous or not.
And this is before October 7th.
Way before October 7th. And I did that for the 3 years in which I was in the university. And I had a night job. I was a security guard at my university. Mm-hmm. So I used to sit at my night job and do my volunteering hours there and, you know, do my other things related to that, to studies there. But I used to sit on my ass and just for like 4 hours a day, just look at anti-Semitic posts and content online and remove it.
What kind of posts would you see? What kind of content?
Well, anything you can think of at this point. Anything.
I honestly am so naive to many things, and especially since I don't speak Arabic, mm-hmm. I don't know what to expect at all. Anything that you remember that sticks in mind?
Well, I remember so many. For instance, that was the first time I came across the Protocols of Elders of Zion.
In Arabic.
Which is, I know it, you know it, they're fabricated, they're lies, they're not true to any extent. But that was the first time I saw them, because I started to see a trend ongoing of people sharing different versions of the alleged protocols and of Elders in Zion in Arabic on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Like, this is what the Jews are doing in Palestine. This is what they're doing. This is their aim. If you want to truly to understand what they want, you got to look at the Elders of Zion to understand how the Jew mind work and behave. And I saw this.
And I have to ask, because just to be clear, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion was Soviet or Russian, I guess, before mm-hmm. it was Tsarist propaganda.
Mm-hmm. And they
it
did.
Has nothing to do with Israelis. You know, this is way, way, way before. When people share it in Arabic, do they say this is what the Jews are planning, or this is what the Israelis or Zionists are planning?
Well, here's the thing, because it was Russian in its origin, but it was translated in Arabic and was distributed in different regions and in the Middle East and different countries as a way to recruit, let's say, or to encourage people to antagonize or view Israel and Jews as the aggressor. Mm-hmm. Because why? Israel is backed by Uncle Sam and, you know, the West versus the Soviets and all these kind of things. That was during the 70s. But every once in a while, every couple of years, it makes a comeback, the Protocols of Elders of Zion. But when they do talk about this, they say in Arabic, B'nai Sahyun, which translate to the Sons of Zion, which is a reference to Jews. So 99% of the time, even when they say Zionists, they mean Jews. Mm.
So you'd see that whatever things were popping up.
So I've seen that. I've seen Holocaust denial, Holocaust justification, Holocaust distortion, sometimes even all in one post. All in, like, which the logic behind the mind of the anti-Semite sometimes can be very fascinating.
So it was basically the Holocaust didn't happen. It yeah. happened differently. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It's okay, but it happened. That's the
exactly.
Thing
and wants. We will repeat the Holocaust again. Mm. Just, you see, it's like it never happened, but we will repeat it just because. And these are like the same themes that go over and over and over again. And the thing is, it's not something that is in new or in like the invention of the wheel or something like groundbreaking. It's the same old anti-Semitism that is dressed each time in a new dress over and over again. It's the same. Even now, what we're seeing in different U.S. campuses and different Western campuses with students saying Zionists are parasites. Well, you know, the Nazis used to say that Jews are parasites. You know what I mean? So it's like it's the same lady in different dress.
And when you'd find this kind of content online, what would you do to get it removed?
Oh, we see, during my time that organization, what we used to do is we used to create reports. We used to have like big files. I still have some of those files in my laptop. Big files of all the anti-Semitic content with screenshots, URLs, description of what is the content is saying, comparing, looking at IRA definitions of anti-Semitism to see if they apply to any of these posts, and trying to come with a big bulk of anti-Semitic data to the companies and say to Facebook, hey, we saw 300 posts coming from different people all saying these kind of things about Jews. Maybe you should remove them. And most of the part, the platforms did apply and did remove them, depending on the kind of the platform. But that was what I did as volunteering prior to October 7th, way, way before October 7th, because I was very passionate about combating anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism online.
So now let's get to October 7th.
Let's get to October 7th.
Before we get to your reaction to it, where were you on October 7th?
October 7th, October 6th. Came after the longest, most stressful period in my life. Because during my 3 years in university, in Reichman University, I didn't rest. I used to, as I told you, I worked like night shifts. I had maybe three different internships that I did throughout the year with my school, with my work. I didn't sleep at all during those three years. So after the graduation, I was like, okay, I'm like, I need some time to rest. I need some time to be with myself and, you know, just to be, in serenity. But then, my brother got sick, and I have one brother, his name is, Samir, and, he got sick with some sort of a weird disease, weird bacteria that, ate away his liver. So he had to undergo a surgery. So we had to go all the way to France with him, which I stayed there for like a full month, and we came back. And we came back maybe like a month before October 7th. So I was still fatigued, still tired from the university, from the school, from life, from everything. And I just moved into a new apartment. So the general feeling of Tamer Masudin at the time is like, I feel like I have six jobs and I'm tired. I need to rest. I don't need anybody to talk to me. I don't need anybody to approach me. But then I woke up roughly around 7 a.m. ish on October 7th to the sounds of sirens and rockets falling from the sky.
Where were you living at the time?
I was in Ramat HaSharon. Mm-hmm. I was in Ramat HaSharon.
So central
Tel Aviv. Yeah, central Israel, next to Tel Aviv, I would say. So I was like, I was extremely confused, and the dates and the entire dates schedule, everything was scrambled in my head when I woke up. And the first thought that came into my head was, is this Memorial Day? I was like, why there are sirens outside? Is this, did I miss something? Like something happened? And I didn't run to the shelter. My first line of thought was, I am confused. I want to understand what's going on. And my instincts weren't like, let me go to hiding. I was like looking outside of the window like an idiot, trying to figure out what's going on. And if you're watching this, don't do this. Go to the shelter. Don't be me. So I looked out of the window and I saw what I saw. And I started thinking about my brother. And why did I tell you the story about my brother? Because he was in Sderot. He was in Sderot. And the shooting between Hamas terrorists and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad terrorists in Sderot at the police center was like a minute away from him. And when I came there, when I went there, I saw the building that he stayed there. I looked at the side of the building, it filled with bullet holes. And my mom was supposed to go pick him up, but when she heard the sirens, she went back and she turned all the way to Segev Shalom, which was the best decisions that she could make at the moment. So my brother was in Sderot, which is what, like, I'd say half an hour away from the Gaza Strip, even less. Yeah. And I was extremely anxious. My main priority was, I want my siblings to be safe. I want my parents to be safe. And I want my brother to be at his parents' house with my parents. because he was visiting friends and family members, and we didn't think that, you know, we're going to be attacked the morning after that. So a couple of soldiers and volunteers came to him 2 days when he was there, and they picked him up and they drove him all the way to Segev Shalom. But his condition at the time deteriorated a little bit because he had to take his medication regularly, and all the stress, all the things that were happening next to him made him really unwell, until he went back to Segev Shalom and he recovered. So at the time, at the early days, I was extremely confused. And this is where God's plans go into motion, because on the 8th of October, I was supposed to start working for an organization called Cyberwell, which combats anti-Semitism online again. But this time not as a volunteer, but as, you know, official title job, as I was an analyst. And what's unique about Cyberwell is that they do that with by looking at the policies of the social media platforms and see where exactly the content and the policies, you know, where's the connection there, and see, okay, the content violates this policy specifically. So there's more incentives for the company, for Facebook, Meta, whatever, to remove it. And I was supposed to start working there on October 8th. It's supposed to be like, you know, a smooth sailing. And then October happened. I remember my boss calling me the same day and telling me, hey, I know that you're supposed to start working tomorrow. I know that we said it's going to be a smooth sailing and maybe going to take your time onboarding you to how to use OSINET, open source network intelligent tools, and all these kind of things. But, you know, it's shit hit the fan, and we need you like to be with us. So the first couple of months of October 7th, this is what I did. I sat on my laptop. I was working and combating anti-Semitism and hate speech online, getting rid of as many videos of Al-Qassam, of propaganda, all these kind of things as possible. And I did so much that when I left the company and to study here, I looked at how much data I processed alone by myself, and I was there for the month that I was working there. And it was roughly 25-26% of all the data that they had about anti-Semitism. And that's crazy, because I was extremely devoted, extremely passionate about, because for me, it felt like it's the only thing that I can do right now.
Can I ask you, as someone who's been, especially online, doing this work for a time now and tracking things, were you surprised by a big part of the world's reaction to the October 7 massacre?
No, not really. I would say not really. It wasn't as a surprise, because I would say that what we are seeing right now, the reaction, the whole thing that is blowing up, the campus riots, the everything that we're seeing right now wasn't on a whim, wasn't spontaneous. It was planned, because when you have, you know, foreign countries such as Qatar that funds the same terrorist organizations that we are fighting, that also puts the money in the same institutions, academic institutions that, you know, young Americans go and study and to get educated there. And when you have all these small semi-terroristic student organizations working in between, trying to recruit as much young minds as they can, and waiting for a meeting, waiting for a call, waiting for something to happen so that they can go out in the streets and do what they trained to do, what they believe that it was the right thing and it is the right things to do for them. And so I wasn't surprised. I wasn't shocked, to be honest, of the response of people in the world. I was more surprised by the response of Israelis, I would say. And because when October 7th happened, I started to see a lot of videos from my Bedouin community of people, religious scholars, political leaders, just people with influences, with many young followings, you know, people who follow them, starting to speak and say, well, this is a terrorist organization that is attacking us, all of us, Jews.
So you were positively surprised.
Yeah, positive way, all of us, because I thought it's going to be like, you know, any other operations that happens. any other, you know, escalation between Israel and Hamas, that, you know, maybe somebody will post something on Facebook, but the most of the time people are like, okay, it's like life, this is what it is. But I think maybe because the devastation, the atrocities, and also the fact that many Bedouins were kidnapped and killed also in October 7th, and also many Bedouins went and saved lives on October 7th also, which is something that is very important to note, which is I take deep pride in that, in my community, for doing that.
I think just two facts for people that are listening or watching and don't know. The youngest casualty of October 7 was a 14-hour-old Bedouin baby who was shot through her mom while her mom was in labor. They were able to save the baby, but just for a few hours. And the other thing is I think one of the only, if maybe not the only, casualty of a Hamas missile was also in a Bedouin village.
You see, when that happened, the thing is about us Bedouins is that we are traditional, and we are very proud people. We take our part in the Israeli society very seriously. Of course, we have, let's say, our own demands from different governments, but these are requests between, let's say, a group of with interest between them and the regulators, and it happens between each and every country. Like, for example, here in the U.S., we have this own thing with Israeli governments, but we always felt pride in being part of Israel, part of the country. So when that happened, and when you have a group that is passionate, that is proud, and it hit us real deep, to the extent that I remember there was a Bedouin family that put a bounty on the Hamas member that killed their son. And he was shot on camera and video, and he was telling the Hamas members and shouting at them in Arabic, telling them, "I am Arab just like you. I am Muslim. What are you doing? Why are you shooting me? I'm not. What do you want from me? I'm not a soldier. I'm not anything." And they killed him. And when the family saw that, they put a bounty on the people who killed him, so that they can find him and seek justice. So when I saw members of my community, you know, engaging and saying, or creating, let's say, opening their houses for the people of the South, and said, you know what, you can come to Rahat and stay with us if you want, you can come here, and like at any peaceful time, you couldn't think about this as something that could happen. But I don't know, maybe it's the threat of annihilation at that moment that made us all stick together and say, you know what, like maybe we fight sometimes, maybe we don't agree always on anything, but the fact that this group of terrorist organization, this group of terrorist organization came for my head and your head, so we're gonna ally together.
And you've shifted your activity, I guess, a little bit since October 7. Now, instead, or maybe in addition to removing anti-Semitic content, you seem to be more active in fighting misinformation. Uh-huh, uh-huh. So what is your activity now?
Well, as stated, like before, during the early days of October 7th, so I was, you know, trying as much as I can to remove social media posts and stuff like that. But it felt that I'm not doing enough, and it didn't, the effect on me was very, very heavy. I felt like, you know, I'm not a soldier, so I can't pick up the weapon and go fight for my country. I can volunteer, I can, you know, like, I don't know, go to different organizations and offer myself, but I wanted to do more. The little peacock in my head, the nudnik, kept telling me that you need to do more. So I opened up my phone and I recorded a video in Arabic in which I said, Hamas is like ISIS. It's a terrorist organization. I don't affiliate it with it. It doesn't represent me as an Arab and as a Muslim. I didn't come and criticize the Palestinians. I didn't come to... Let me rephrase that. I didn't begin with criticizing the Palestinians. I didn't say anything about the PLO or, I don't know, the history or all the things. I came with a simple message. Hamas is a terrorist organization. They killed members of my community, and they kidnapped people of my community, and I'm going to speak about this. And And the reception was mixed because it got, I think, 1 million views in the first couple of days, all of a sudden. I did it with the help of Yusuf Khaddad. Shout out to him. I did it with him. So it got a million of views. And I said, you know what? Maybe I should post more. And my friends tried to encourage me, you should do that. You should come out. You should speak more. You should talk more. You can do that. And I hesitated at first because I don't like being on social media as much as... this is going to be a shock for the people that follow me. Oh my God, this is going to be a shock. But I don't like to be on social media as much as I do.
Me neither. I hate being on social media. It's a tool now, but yeah.
I love people, but social media is a different thing. Yeah. And, you know, they encouraged me. They said, you know what? You posted a video, I got a million views. Keep going. Keep doing this. And I said, this is the more that I've been thinking about with myself. So I did more than just release, you know, removing anti-Semitic content from social media platforms. I looked at the content. I studied it. I knew how the mind of an anti-Semite and anti-Zionist think. And with the help of my social media, I encountered that. So it was like my own version of war, I would say. So I was battling on two fronts. I was doing the social media on removing the content behind the scenes, and also in front of the scenes, speaking and talking and engaging and having like this complete shell coming out of, you know, me being this presenter to say, I know what I'm speaking about. I know what I'm talking about because I've seen it. I know it. I studied it.
And who's your audience? Because most of the time now you do content in English.
Exactly, right? Yeah.
Who is your audience?
Well, at the beginning, it was young Arabs. It was young Arabs between the ages of 17 to, let's say, 35. And this is why I began with making videos in Arabic. But for my... Sadly, it didn't catch as much traction and as I wanted to catch, and it didn't get... to as many people as I wanted to get. So I shifted a little bit when I saw the entire campus camp and riots and everything that is going on. And I said, you know what? I'm going to still speak to young folks like me, but I'm going to do it in English now. I still can do this in Arabic, but I want to do this in English now because I feel like this is a burning bush that needs to be addressed. And I did that. But nowadays, my content, I do it mostly in English. Recently, I also did a video in Arabic because I wanted to flex on social media online. And also did in Hebrew because people thought that I don't speak Hebrew. And all the comments were, oh my God, do you speak Hebrew? I didn't know that you speak Hebrew.
I got to say, I was on a podcast in Hebrew and everyone was like, his Hebrew is perfect. How did you learn Hebrew? And I said, only 27 years of living in Israel.
Exactly.
You know?
I'm like, what part of saying that I am Israeli don't you get? And it's funny, but yeah, it's...
Do you also get negative reactions?
Oh my God. Honey, I open my phone in the morning and the first thing that I see is death threats every morning. Oh my God.
From who?
From who? Mostly.
Like what, from what demographic? Nah, don't say names.
No. Thing is, the people who threaten me don't think that I can locate them online, but I know how to do that. I don't do that. I will not do that because I'm a nice person, but... When you threaten people online, you're not as anonymous as you think you might be. You're not. The kind of the threats that I receive, mostly death threats, mostly racial slurs, N-word this, N-word that, you slave, you, all the nice stuff that I call them love packages that I receive in the morning. And usually it comes from men, and mostly Middle Eastern men. And... Sometimes even Palestinian men who come at me on my social media and comments and sending me messages and threaten me. And it's not going to deter me. It's not going to scare me away. But that is the truth. Those are the most people who come and threaten me with violence. I had people who came and, you know, to criticize or to say, like, I don't agree with that specific thing. I want to talk to you about it. And I did engage and I did talk to them about it.
That's perfect. That's what's supposed to happen, yeah, in a democracy.
Yeah, yeah. And I had people who came at first with a lot of tension, and because, you know, this issue is very personal to them. And I talked to them and went fine because, you know, I de-escalated the conversation. Okay, let's talk. I'm not even talking to the 80,000 people that I have on my social media right now. I'm talking to you because you came to me and you wanted to discuss something. So I'm gonna give you the time to talk and really ask what you want, and I'm gonna tell you how I feel and how I think. Mm-hmm. And I did that for a really long time with a lot of people who came, you know, who reached out to me individually. But that criticism, constructive criticism, came from Western minds, but threats came from our region.
I want to also better understand the internal aspects of in Israel society. I think it's extremely important, especially for Jewish people and non-Jewish people that don't live in Israel. I saw you give a very, very thought-provoking talk in Hebrew about political polarization in Arab culture in Israel. And you talked about two trends that are happening, two opposing trends, Israelization and Palestinization. Can you explain a little bit what's going on?
You found my video in the university, I see.
I know how to find things online as
perfect,
well.
Perfect. You see, now you becoming the teacher again. Well, yeah, at the time I was attending an event at my university. I wanted to speak about something that when I was at the university, I saw it, which is that there's a current, I wouldn't say fight, but there's a, I would say, a tension when it comes to the identity of Israeli Arabs. Not from the outside as much as it's from the inside, the tension and the rift. Because on one end, you have Israeli Arabs who come and say, I am Israeli, my passport is Israeli, my country is Israel, I don't consider myself to be Palestinian. And you have other portion from inside the Israeli society who say, I am Palestinian, but with Israeli citizenship. I work in the country, I contribute, I feel part of the country, but I'm still Palestinian in my own view, in my own perspectives. And in between, you know, those two rifts and two identities, every time there is a escalation, there is, you know, for example, this ongoing war between Israel and Hamas and the Palestinian Jihad, Islamic Jihad, when you have all these tensions going on, then you have also the tensions between the Arab community as itself. And we start asking ourselves questions and to which direction you want to go, what it's going on, what it's happening. Even though when you have like, you know, surveys that say, for example, I'm making this number in my head, three out of every four Arabs in Israel consider themselves to be Israelis, and Arab Israelis and not Palestinians, or other polls or other things, when times are intense and when you have Al Jazeera at your home, or when you have social media as a main source of information and stuff like that happen, then the rift opens and all of a sudden you have to start asking yourself and the people around you these kind of questions. And sometimes you have to answer, because from the Palestinian perspective, I would say the radical Palestinian perspective, they look at Arab Israelis as traitors. They look at them as, you know, collaborators. They look at them as the ones that sold out, because you are living the good life. You are the one who are in Israel. You are the one who have Israeli passport. You are the ones who can go to the U.S. and Europe without any issues and travel and do all these kind of things. You are the ones who are living in prosperity. Mm-hmm. And also, you are the ones who collaborated with the filthy Jews. How dare you? How could you do something like that? In the extreme radical Palestinian circles, I would say. And also because of the fact that you have, you know, Arab Israelis who marry from Judah and Samaria, Palestinians from there, and they marry together and come back to live inside of the Israeli, inside Israeli territory. And you have a kid, which some of my friends were, that grows up to an Israeli Arab mom and a Palestinian Arab, Israeli Arab dad and Palestinian mother. And he grows up in the house and he learns two different things. And somehow he goes out and develops identity crisis to which side do I go to? Who is my main go to? I've seen that. I've seen that. And I had to experience that with a group of my friends when we were in school, which I would say were very, very, very harsh, very rough, very difficult to have these kind of conversations, because for me, I never identified as Palestinian, because none of the claims that were said or made by Palestinians really felt that, you know, can be addressed to me, or I never felt the same way. I can say that I'm not from my skin color, from my family, I'm not we're not indigenous to the Levant, we're not indigenous to the Middle East. I can say that I don't have a a family history that roots, I don't know how many thousand years or decades to the land of Israel. I know where we came from, the area that we came from, and how we became what we became, but that's a different story. So in all of this, when you have us Arab Israelis and you have these discussions, so it can be really tough, it can be really difficult, but I feel like ever since October 7th, something in the mindset of most Arab Israelis changed.
That was my next question. So where did it change? Did it move more towards the Israelization, or did it split people more?
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is about the Israeli Arab society is that it's not one, because you have the Druze community in the north, you have the Bedouin community in the south, you have the Arab community in the Triangle area, and all these, you know, different communities, which we share the same language, and most of us, you know, follow the same religion, and we most of us have the same kind of culture and food. But when it comes to politics, we behave differently sometimes. Mm-hmm. So you can see that, for example, Druze and Israeli Bedouins are more likely to go to the army, are more likely to, let's say, do national service, and more likely to be integrated in the Israeli society and compared to other Israeli Arabs in, let's say, the Triangle era. And when October happened, I can say in the Bedouin society, at least, and also I can speak and say about the Druze community, people were extremely angry, and they knew for a fact that, you know, Hamas is a terrorist organization. These are our enemies, and they're trying to annihilate us and kill us and kidnap us and do all of these horrific things to us, and we can't let that happen. So a fight for us is a fight for the homeland. And I remember Kaid Farhan al-Qadi, who was one of the Bedouin hostages who was released, when he came out and spoke to the public and said, you know, Hamas took me and they beat me up and they told me, where are the Jews? And I said, I don't have any Jews. I'm not going to give you any Jews, because I don't have any Jews to give you, and I'm not going to give you anything. And he said that that is something that he learned from his father and his grandfather, who felt, you know, part of the Israeli society even before when different migrations came and different groups of came to the land of Israel. They felt part of the Jewish community. They wanted to be part of that. And so for him, it wasn't even a suggestion to give Jews up. Like, I'm not going to give you any Jews. I don't have anything to give you. That was the mindset, and still is the mindset among many, if not all, the Bedouins that I know, that I've been around. And I can say the same about the Druze community as well, fiercely loyal. But when it comes to other sects of Arab Israelis, it's difficult to say, really. You have most, I would say, would lean to the fact that, well, this is our country, this is our home. It's not perfect, but we love it. I'm not going to change it. And maybe you can find like a small minority who would say, I'm not Israeli, I'm Palestinian, but it's force of, forced to live here, forced to be here. But it's, if it was up to me, it wouldn't be my first choice. But you can see that, because again, when it comes to the Arab society in Israel, the same with every society, in every area, you have groups of people who think differently.
And then let's talk about, the other part of that, that's within the Arab Israeli culture, or society, but what about Jewish Arab or Jewish Bedouin relationships in Israel?
Mm-hmm. So I would say that when it comes to Jewish and Bedouin relationships, relations in Israel, we are very close. We are very tight. I remember seeing my mom walking around the house with the Star of David because her Jewish friend gave it to her and she wanted to wear it, so she still has it. That is one example. And I said about my grandfather who fought in 1948 in the War of Independence. Half of my cousins, all of them came from, all of them Bedouins, all of them went to serve in the IDF to be in combat units and do very courageous and very powerful things for the nation. So we feel part. Sometimes we, you know, in the Bedouin community, you can hear voices of dissatisfaction with current governments or specific regulations or specific things that related to demands of the Bedouin community from the country. Like we said before, the infrastructure and the facilities and stuff that we require. But it doesn't, I would say, it doesn't take over the love for the country. Like, I love my country. I want my country to do more things for me, but I'm not going to throw my country away just because.
What is a way for Jewish Israelis and maybe even Jewish Americans, Jews in the diaspora, to get closer and connect with Arab Bedouins in Israel?
I'm going to counter and say that from my own perspective, I think that it's important for Jews in Israel and Jews in the diaspora and Jews across to reconcile and find to agree on something. Because from looking at the outside, from the perspective from the outside again, when I see a group of, let's say, anti-Zionist Jews walking around saying, you know, Israel is a terrorist state, Israel is an apartheid state, Israel doesn't have a right to exist. And I say this as a Jew, and you have Jews in the land of Israel who are being, you know, targeted, being shot at, being, you know, the target of terrorist attacks because they are Jews, because they are Israelis, because of who they are. And we know that this is classic old anti-Semitism coming all over again to hunt the Jews again, because it's a beast that never rests. And I feel, and this is my own criticism of let's say the Jewish community overall, that when it comes to the way, let's say, the connections between Jews in Israel and Jews in the diaspora, I think that I would love to see more of that connection. I would love to see more talks, more engagement, more about the differences. Because obviously when you're living outside of Israel as a Jew, you view Israel as something. But when you live inside of Israel, you view it as something else. But to answer your question, I think that...
I just have to say, before you answer my question, it's so... You're really incredible young man. That you, I asked you about what can Jews do to better connect with Bedouins. Well, let's think about how Jews can first connect with themselves. And I love that. That's okay. Yeah, so...
But I'm saying this because as someone who's from the outside... looking and knowing that Israel is the land of Israel, is the past of the Jewish history, it's the present of the Jewish history, and also it's the future for Jews. It's your home, it's your past, it's your future all in once. So maybe, you know, maybe you look at it and say, I don't want to live there because, I don't know, rent is too high, or I don't like the fact that rockets fall on my head every year and a half, which is bad for business. Which I can understand. I can understand. But seeing the different groups who don't really care whether you are liberal Jew, non-liberal Jew, Jew living in New Jersey or in Boston or in Israel, whatever, they see a keep on your head. They want to target you. They want to, you know, they see you as an enemy. How many anti-Semitic incidents have happened here in the past 15 months? In the US, in Europe, or in Australia alone. Even before October 7th, even before that, anti-Semitism was an all-time high due to COVID and all the conspiracies that came after that. And to see that, I really want to see more Jews connect and interconnect between those who live in Israel and those who live in the diaspora, because there's no place like home. Regardless how you feel about, you know, your family.
That. There's no place like home. Before we end, I want to ask you one question.
We're ending already?
I know.
Oh my God. Wow.
The best conversations fly like this.
Exactly.
You write for Haaretz. And 4 years ago, a Arab Muslim Bedouin member of Knesset, member of parliament, passed away, and you wrote in sort of obituary and about him, and you wrote the title was "Who Will Pick Up the Torch of Bedouin Leadership." Is that something in the cards for you? Bedouin leadership, Israeli leadership, the next prime minister.
Nah, I don't want to be a prime minister. It's too much work. It's too much work. I don't think anybody want to see me with a tie walking around from one meeting to another meeting with all the headaches that I'm going to have to deal with. But jokes aside, when I wrote that article, I don't write for Haaretz anymore, but at the time when I did, you see, the Bedouin community didn't have many, you know, representations in the Israeli parliament. not because of the structure of the Israeli parliament, but, you know, mostly because not many Bedouin political leaders were interested in going to politics. So it's very, very local politics, which we, when you compare the voting, let's say, percentage between Bedouins, when it's local elections compared to national elections, you see when it comes to local elections, everybody vote. Everybody, because it's families that, you know, compete for a seat at the table. But when it's national elections, everybody say, we can't win. And in my criticism for my community, well, I say, well, if you look at your family and say, well, I want to vote for my family, so my family member can, the head of my family member can sit in the office and can give a lot of benefits to me, why not think about all the Bedouin community as one family and say, okay, how can we pick, like, let's say, a couple of people from different big families that we trust them and we know that they can benefit all of us, and we push them forward. And when it comes to leadership in the Bedouin community, I think there's a lot of good things that are happening behind the scene and people not aware of. For example, there's this cool program that is called... it's called Desert Stars, Kuchave Amidbar. And I used to be participant in the program for one year. I did a lot of things when I was a kid, by the way. So I used to be a participant, and it's a leadership program for young Bedouins. I highly recommend, there's a documentary about it in Kan 11 for if you want to watch. Sadly, it's with Hebrew subtitles for your viewers, so maybe they can watch it. Not all of them.
No, but they got to start learning Hebrew.
But it's important because during that time, when they filmed the series, there was an escalation between Israel and Hamas. You can see kids who are 17, 15, 16 at the time, driving on the bus all the way to the south. And discussing Gaza-Israel politics and fighting in between and all of this. And it's a great program because it's developed the leadership, the next upcoming leadership, the Bedouin leadership in the Negev. And the more I see it, the more I like it because I want to see more people who come from my community pushing themselves. And, you know, I want my community to invest in itself, to push forward, to be the forefront of the Israeli society and not rely on politicians who come from, let's say, Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or whatever to come and say, hey, I want to help the Bedouins. No, we are the Bedouins. We will help ourselves. We just need to believe in ourselves to do that. And regarding the long future, I'm thinking about going into politics. Maybe one day somebody will pull up this interview and say, hey, you remember when you said that you're going into politics? Yeah. So yeah, it's going to happen. But if it's going to happen, I'm not going to be... coming as the Bedouin leader. I'm going to come as someone who's going to represent the nation of Israel if I was, you know, if there were enough people to elect me and say, you know what, we believe in you.
You have one vote here already.
Because from my perspective, I don't want people to look at me and say, well, he's a great leader because he's Bedouin and so I'm going to go for him. Or he's a great leader because he's black, so I'm going to go for him. Because it's a country, it's not a DEI project. I want people to look at the things that I say and my actions and hopefully think that I'm qualified enough to be in that position. If that ever happens and I receive the torch, it's going to be both a duty and a privilege to do that. And hopefully I'll be able to do that and accomplish as much as I can. But between us, me and you, no one other looking at the camera.
Between me and you and 20,000 subscribers on 20,000, YouTube and hundreds of thousands of downloads on.
Yeah. I really want to be in the foreign ministry out of all the ministries, because I really want to work behind the scene to focus on building connections and relations between Israel and the Arab countries that we have in the region. We have a really warm peace with UAE and Morocco, which we love and they love us back. But I want to also see that kind of peace with Jordan and Egypt and hopefully other countries. And for that to happen, I think that we need more young leadership in that aspect that knows how young folks think and talk. And hopefully, I think I can do a pretty decent job in that position.
Man, if I was like even half as insightful and articulate as you are when I was your age, We're going to end the episode with the Here I Am rapid fire lightning round. So a series of questions. There's no right or wrong answer. Just All shoot right. the first thing that comes to
Let's
mind.
Let's go.
Okay.
I'm good at goes.
Thomas Udin, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Again, what is what?
One thing people don't know about you.
I hate tea.
What is one thing people don't know about Bedouins?
We don't like snow.
What is your favorite curse?
Fuck.
When was the last time you cried?
In Moana, the movie.
Number one or number two?
Number one.
What happened?
I can't tell you that you said rapid questions.
Okay, all right. I respect that. If you could be invited for Shabbat dinner with any Jewish person in history, dead or living, who would that be?
Oh, Albert Einstein. Easy.
What is your favorite holiday?
Ooh, Pesach.
Why?
The matzot. I love the chocolate and the matzot. It's tasty.
Okay. What is your least favorite holiday?
Ooh, Yom Kippur.
When do you feel safest?
In the bathroom.
I'll keep going. When do you feel least safe?
In front of the camera.
Really? In front of the camera?
Yeah.
You fake it well?
Well, you fake it until you make it. It's because when I was a kid, I had a lot of insecurities. But because I had a good mom and still have a good mom, and a strong woman who pushed me to break through and you know, just not be scared. So I did everything crazy that, you know, I thought of. So I went to theater and I studied and I did all of this, but it still remains an insecurity for me.
Okay. What gives you hope?
The human capital of Israel.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Mm-hmm. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
Cyberwell.
And remind people what they do?
See, Cyberwell is an organization that combats anti-Semitism online using data. And I love that company, I love it. And I think that they're doing a very important work and job. Not only by collecting the data, but also by working together with the platforms to remove as much hate as they can. And I know the team, and I know that behind the scenes they've been working effortlessly to do so. And I think they deserve donations.
All right. Tamer, where can people find you?
Online or in Brandeis University.
So don't tell me where in Brandeis, but online, where, give me the tag. So.
Ooh, online you can find me at Tamer Masoudin. T. Masoudin. And
M-A-S-U-D-I-N, just so people...
Exactly, yeah. Also on Twitter, you can find me there. Or you can write my name in English, Tamer Masoudin, in Google, and you will find me.
There's not many Tamer Masoudins?
Only one.
I agree. It's been a pleasure. I can't believe the time is already...
It is.
...ended, but... I can't wait to see what you're up to next and have you again to talk about the future.
Hopefully when I become a foreign minister.
Yes, and I will be in your corner. I'll be voting for you and maybe you consider me as a minister of education.
Perfect. We need ministers of education.
I am extremely delighted to say here I am with Tamer Masoudin.
Here we are. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."